Hello and welcome to the Alzheimer's Solution Show. According to the Alzheimer's Association, Alzheimer's disease is the only cause of death in the top 10 in America that cannot be prevented, cured, or slowed. But what if it is preventable? Ralph Sanchez believes Alzheimer's can be prevented in some cases, especially if you look at your risk for Alzheimer's disease long before a diagnosis that is not reversible. Ralph Sanchez is a functional medicine specialist with 20 years in the field as a practitioner and consultant, and he's author of the forthcoming book, The Diabetic Brain. I'm Bonnie Wagner Stafford, and on the Alzheimer's Solution Show, Ralph Sanchez and I will explore the latest research on what contributes to your risk of developing Alzheimer's and how you and your loved ones can best protect yourselves. Today is the third of our three-part series on Chapter 1 of The Diabetic Brain, Ralph's forthcoming book. In the first show, we explored the details surrounding Ralph's journey in the field of Alzheimer's research, along with the model of brain insulin resistance, or type 3 diabetes, and Ralph's eventual inspiration to author The Diabetic Brain. In the second show, we went deeper into the link between heart disease, type 2 diabetes, how it raises your risk for dementia, and why it is all associated with type 3 diabetes. Today, on the third show, we will talk about chronic inflammation and oxidative stress. We'll examine their roles in chronic disease patterns and why these are essential pieces to be aware of and understand, because they too raise your risk for all of the chronic degenerative diseases associated with aging. Hello, Ralph.
Hi, Bonnie. Thanks again for hosting our show.
My pleasure. So before we get into the connection with Alzheimer's, I would like to start by asking if you could explain what exactly chronic inflammation is and what oxidative stress is. Chronic inflammation, for example, sounds painful.
Yes, well, it can be. As a matter of fact, let's begin with inflammation there on that tone. And everybody learns about what that is like as a child with all the bumps and bruises one inevitably experiences. And we are taught that the redness and the pain associated with all of that is inflammation, right? And then as we mature and get into adulthood, we learn that some of the health issues we begin to notice as chronic problems are in part inflammation-related issues. For example, allergies and sinusitis, which is really common. And we all know that allergies and sinusitis are part of this inflammation response that occurs with the inflammation in those tissues. And joint pain is another example, or osteoarthritis is the designated term for that. So itis, I-T-I-S, we begin to learn is all part of these pro-inflammatory responses in the body, and that they represent issues related to these inflammation cascades that are causing either chronic pain or health issues. And in some cases, this can be very serious illnesses, such as autoimmune disease or hepatitis. Now, in part, what is going on with some of these issues are immune system reactions. When your immune system is activated, it is a pro-inflammatory response to a problem, and it is attempting to respond to these problems and control them, such as infections. So when you get a common cold or a flu, the symptoms are not caused by that infection, but they're instead a side effect of that inflammatory response. And again, more serious illnesses or chronic infections like Lyme disease. These are all representative stimulus that triggers the immune system and starts to cause this whole pro-inflammatory response in the body. Other examples include the very foods we eat. And in some cases, we just do not tolerate them. So we understand that gluten intolerance is a problem because you cannot digest gluten. And that starts to set in motion a whole inflammatory response in the digestive tract, which is a pivot to inflammation-related issues in the body. So inflammation, in terms of these problems that I'm describing, are not just isolated components in the body. They travel throughout the body and will eventually start to trigger these pro-inflammatory responses in certain tissues, depending upon what you're more susceptible to expressing in terms of a disease pattern. So when I mentioned gluten intolerance, that is a very classical example of an inflammatory condition in the digestive tract. But another part of these digestive issues that will tend to generate inflammation are food allergies. And food allergies are actually a huge component of a lot of people's health issues, and they don't even know about it because they're not these acute responses. They're subacute responses, or so they're chronic responses. And so you can be eating foods that just don't agree with you, that you are ramping up some sensitivities and thus some immune responses to, and thus creating inflammation in the body. And over time, this can be a significant component to driving some disease processes that you are more susceptible. So these gut-mediated or food-mediated or toxin-mediated stimulus for inflammation can spread a message of inflammation throughout the body, and it will start to manifest in either joint tissues or other tissues. It'll affect your cardiovascular system. It'll affect your brain. Any tissues that you tend to be more susceptible to in terms of expressing that whole disease pattern.
So how does one identify whether there are things that they're consuming or exposing themselves to on a regular basis that are actually causing these damaging inflammatory responses?
That's a great question. And it's all about what I have mentioned in past shows, which is working with very proactive physicians and practitioners that are engaged in looking at these problems with you. So if you're not aware of them, and actually many people are now aware of it, especially in my part of the world here in California, we're made fun of a lot because of these awareness and focus of these types of issues, you know, our health and being so meticulous about observing what may or may not be good for you in that way. And so a lot of people will go to a practitioner and start to ask about why they're not feeling so well. Is it related to their foods? Is it related to certain things that they're doing? And a good practitioner will start to run some tests. So there could be a food allergy test. There's a test for looking at your problems associated with gluten. And there's a great marker of general inflammation in the body. This is one tip I'd like to give today, which is always looking for these biomarkers, which indicate, you know, physiological processes in the body that will give you clues to what is going on, good or bad. And one of them is called CRP, as in Paul. It's a high sensitive CRP test, and that is a generalized marker of inflammation. And that's a good one to include in your blood chemistry analysis, just to get a window into what possibly is going on with inflammation in your body. And there are others as well, too. But looking at labs, looking at tests, particularly when you're not feeling well, being very proactive about why you're not feeling well. So part of the chronic inflammation patterns in our body often manifests as just not feeling that well, tired and achy, and you don't seem to have a good cause or reason for feeling that way. And that's because there are these low-grade issues that you're just not aware of. Because you're not making the link to, oh, it's my diet, oh, it's my lifestyle, oh, it's this or it's that. And you need guidance in terms of identifying those particular issues and perhaps doing some tests to be very accurate about that process.
Just one more question about that. So is it possible that somebody could be eating a healthy lifestyle with lots of fruits and veggies and healthy fats, but some of those foods, for example, soy-based products or something, might be a cause of inflammation? So it might not be necessarily that somebody's eating junk food all the time, but they think they're eating healthy and they're still having issues. Is that possible?
Well, yes. Not everybody is going to have an allergy to soy, but that's a huge allergen. And there are many others as well, too. Grains in general can be a big problem for people. Apart from the gluten problem in grains, you can be sensitive to these grains, particularly wheat. In other words, you can have a gluten intolerance that's part and parcel of these grains, and you can be just allergic to them, which is a separate thing to gluten. And there are many foods like that that one tends to be allergic to more so than other foods. And it's all a bio-individual thing. In other words, we tend to have some sensitivities that we're inclined to manifest that way, depending on lots of different factors. But the more common ones are grains and soy and dairy. And those are the ones to be really highly diligent of not eating too much, because it's eating these foods too much over a period of time that can actually promote these allergy responses. So we've gotten a basic idea of inflammation, where it might be coming from, what's driving it. And for the most part, inflammation is regulated by lots of anti-inflammatory mechanisms. For example, we have these hormones, which are our natural steroids, and one of them is called cortisol. And a lot of people now realize what cortisol represents in the body in terms of being a very important hormone in controlling inflammation. But it also can be quite deleterious, because when you're under a chronic stress response, that is a ramping up cortisol, because cortisol is part of this fight or flight mechanism. And when you're under that kind of stress on a constant basis, you're secreting a lot of cortisol. So the cortisol is important in acute situations. I'll never forget when I was early in my training as a practitioner, I decided to read a book by Dr. Sapolsky, and he wrote a book called Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. And it's just the juxtaposition of the natural world and animals and how they respond to a stressful situation, like a zebra who is being chased by a lion. And there's going to be a huge surge of cortisol in that situation to deal with that stress response. But as soon as that event is over and he survives, or he manages to outrun the lion, then that stress response is done with. His body goes back to a normal rhythm in terms of all of those biochemical and stress responses. But in people, we are constantly under stress. You know, you and I, before we began this discussion today, were just chatting about stress in our lives. And when we're under constant stress and we're not doing the things that counter stress, like exercise, meditation, and plenty of sleep, then we have these cortisol levels that are higher over time and are constantly putting a demand on our adrenal glands and our adrenal reserves, so that too much cortisol over time is an overcompensation and a very bad scenario. And this cortisol secretions at high levels are actually a very damaging process that are involved in many disease patterns, including Alzheimer's disease. In fact, high cortisol levels over time is very injurious to the brain. It's linked to brain damage and Alzheimer's disease. The role for cortisol in memory has been well demonstrated. And an example of that is where our learning and memory processes occur in the hippocampus of the brain. That's the region of the brain where memories are processed and stored. Contains many cortisol receptors, and excess cortisol overwhelms the hippocampus and eventually can cause its atrophy. And in the previous show, I mentioned that the atrophy or the brain volume can actually be an important biomarker that one can look at, especially if one has the genetic marker ApoE4, because ApoE4 genotypes, or people that carry that gene, are born with smaller hippocampus. And if these processes of stress or other processes associated with inflammation start to affect that hippocampus, it causes its shrinkage. And that occurs in other areas of the brain as well, too. So we can see that happening, and it can be a biomarker for when you're starting to have memory problems and you're starting to have cognitive issues that you can start to look at, you know, to see if you actually are more at risk or you are in that prodromal or a pre-Alzheimer's stage where you're starting to have this cognitive decline, and that can actually be measured. That's one of the ways that you can measure it, by looking at the hippocampus and seeing the atrophy, the shrinkage that's occurring.
So I want to make sure that I've got the connection right. Chronic inflammation can be both affected by and caused by excess levels of cortisol, which is caused by, at least in part, excess stress or prolonged stress. And cortisol affects the hippocampus, which starts to affect our ability to ward off brain disease.
Inflammation is not caused by cortisol. So cortisol is part of the stress response, and it's a very important hormone. It's our natural corticosteroid.
Right.
And it's our natural hormone response to inflammation, and it also has a very important role in our immune system. But when you have high cortisol levels over time, it's going to have a very deleterious effect on the body, because cortisol is damaging in excess amounts. And so that relationship that I described with the brain happens with other tissues as well, too, in terms of having a impact that is not good. For example, we talked about obesity and the link of obesity to diabetes and our brain as well, too. So obesity triggers a whole set of inflammatory messengers. They're called chemical messengers of inflammation, or cytokines. And so the more visceral fat you have, the more inflammation you're actually generating there. And cortisol plays a role there. Our visceral fat, it has very high levels of cortisol receptors. So like I said about the hippocampus, they have many cortisol receptors. And so if you have very high levels of circulating cortisol, which is part of a stress response, you're affecting the tissues that have a lot of cortisol receptors, like the brain or the visceral fat, then you're going to have problems with metabolism and inflammation, and you're going to start triggering a whole downward spiral of problems associated with inflammation and those disease processes that are associated with it. Inflammation is also associated with the disease processes that we were covering last week, which is diabetes and heart disease. So those metabolic processes associated with those disorders will tend to produce inflammation in the body. And that inflammation is associated with eventually upping your risk for vascular dementia that's associated with diabetes and cardiovascular disease. Now, inflammation can also be derived from factors related to what are called chronic insults. So if we're getting into this cardiovascular, cerebrovascular disease process, we can start to have strokes and TIAs, which are a reference to smaller strokes events. And then there is, we covered the chronic infection aspect, but the aggregation of a protein in the brain and the end product considered to be amyloid plaque, the traditional hallmark lesion of Alzheimer's disease. The precursors, which we've discussed previously as well too, are these amyloid peptide proteins. And as they aggregate, they can start to stimulate a whole pro-inflammatory cascade in the brain as well. And then there are neurotoxic elements like mercury and pesticides that are very, very toxic to the brain. It can stimulate inflammation as well. So there are many vectors of inflammation that are important to be looking at as part of this whole pro-inflammatory terrain in various diseases and in Alzheimer's disease. We talked a few moments ago about obesity and how visceral fat generates pro-inflammatory messengers or inflammatory cytokines. And one of them is called IL-6 and tumor necrosis factor. And very high levels of those are found in the brain. And those are being generated in the body and traveling into the brain and stimulating pro-inflammatory messages and problems associated with the disease process there.
Right. Okay. So what about oxidative stress?
Well, oxidative stress is, in my book, I gave a really nice, simple explanation. And it's basically an imbalance of where these levels of antioxidants and pro-oxidative molecules are starting to get skewed into a problem where we're not naturally controlling them. So the oxidative balance between antioxidants and free radicals in the body is a very important one. And their body produces a whole family of natural antioxidants molecules. One of them some people may recognize, it's called glutathione. And there are others as well too. And those are very, very important because they're meant to address the issue of pro-oxidative reactions and the generation of what are called free radicals. And that's really key because inflammation will tend to create this oxidative stress in part. And of course, as I just said, if we don't have enough antioxidants that are either being generated in the body or coming from our foods, that's a really important thing to be aware of, because when we talk about our food that way and we are not eating a good balanced diet that is rich in these phytochemicals that are naturally present, and especially in vegetables and fruits that are rich in these phytochemicals, which are natural antioxidants and natural anti-inflammatory molecules, then we're going to be on the short side. And if we are prone to having inflammation, or we're generating inflammation in the body, and we don't have enough of these antioxidants and anti-inflammatory molecules to counter them, then we're going to be generating this condition called oxidative stress. So again, it's really simply a balance between the antioxidants present in our body and free radicals that are being generated for one reason or another. But oxygen is a central part to all of that. So oxygen is a very, very important molecule. We need it because it is extremely important to how we metabolize food. We oxidize food, and that's where the term oxygen is related to. So we're oxidizing our food in this metabolic process that's referred to as cellular respiration. And a lot of people may remember in their biochemistry classes talking about the Krebs cycle, because a lot of us had to learn the Krebs cycle and it was a pain in the butt. And the Krebs cycle is all about how we metabolize energy and these energy-producing organelles in the cells that are referred to as the mitochondria. And oxygen is critical to that process. The mitochondria function in an oxygen-rich environment. But a part of that is that they're producing these oxygen molecules that are very reactive. And oxygen combines readily with all other molecules. And when they start doing that, they start producing very potent free radicals. So if you don't have these natural antioxidants present in the body to control all of this, you're going to start getting skewed over more towards the production of free radicals that are not getting control, and that's an oxidative stress problem. So you need antioxidants to control those processes, and when you don't have them, then you're going to get into an oxidative stress condition, which is now known like inflammation, to not only be part and parcel of the disease process of many chronic degenerative diseases associated with aging, but it also can stimulate it. So over time, if you're eating a really bad diet and you're not getting these good, healthy phytochemicals, these antioxidants and anti-inflammatories, you are going to be skewed over towards a more unhealthy state because you're going to be more prone to inflammation and this oxidative stress issue. So it's an important part of the disease process that occurs and exacerbating the disease process, or it can actually be part of the genesis of it as well, too.
Can I just get you to go back to the beginning of where we just started talking about antioxidants? And you mentioned what you said might be a common one, and I tried to write the word down, but I hadn't heard it before myself. So I thought we could just go back and get you to talk about what that common antioxidant was. It started with a G.
Yes, it's glutathione.
Glutathione. What is that?
G-L-U-T-A-T-H-I-O-N-E. So glutathione is a natural antioxidant that's generated in our body, and it's produced from several amino acids. And those amino acids combine to form glutathione. And glutathione in that way is generated in the body. It's a very important process. And it's also regenerated because glutathione, for example, will get used up in controlling these free radicals. And it has to be regenerated through dietary and also endogenous processes in the body that tends to regenerate that glutathione. So glutathione is a very central part of all that, and so is another one called SOD, which is called superoxide dismutase. And these are very important natural endogenous and antioxidants that the body produces.
Is there a pill you can take?
Yes. So you can take glutathione, and that can be very, very important. As a matter of fact, in some offices, they will offer glutathione drips when there is a need for that in more serious health issues. So the glutathione drip is an intravenous drip into the blood where you're getting glutathione and other nutrients to really up those levels in the body. But you can also take supplements, and the supplementation of glutathione precursors or glutathione itself is very, very popular when you're working in this field of functional medicine. And one of the most popular glutathione precursors is something called N-acetylcysteine. And N-acetylcysteine is well known to be a very, very important nutrient in how it functions in the body. And one of the things it does is contributes to the production of glutathione.
I've heard of that one.
Okay. So moving on from there, this is really important information for the brain, right? And I'll tell you why. So the brain is represents about 2% of the body mass, but it consumes about 20% of the entire oxygen pool that we take in from the environment.
Wow.
Yeah. So again, we're talking about mitochondrial usage of oxygen and other nutrients to metabolize energy, and certain tissues like the brain and the heart and the liver are very rich in mitochondria and have a very high demand for oxygen and these other nutrients to drive those processes. But again, those processes can start to produce what are called reactive oxygen species or free radicals. And if you don't have these antioxidants to control them, then those free radicals are a very damaging force in the body, which either exacerbates the disease process and or causes a lot of damage to our cells. And that's the cellular component to the disease process, and particularly the cellular membrane, which is a very dynamic area and very susceptible to damage. And some tissues are more prone to oxidative damage than others. And they're very important tissues like the cellular membranes because they're largely made of fats. And our brain is largely made of fat. It's estimated that probably 60% of the volume of the brain is fat. And that's why a lot of people make the relationship of fish fat being good for the brain, and indeed it is. Fish fat and the omega-3s that are in fish are very important to that cellular membrane, as are other fats. And those fats are very, very prone to what are called oxidative damage. It's a process called peroxidation. So other cellular components are also very vulnerable to the assaults by free radicals, which includes our very DNA and the protein structures of our cells and our neurons. And again, the mitochondria is at very high risk for oxidative damage. So these, you know, chronic inflammation patterns and these chronic oxidative stress and inflammation patterns, they actually go hand in hand. I describe them as sinister sisters. You can't really separate them. And they're part of what's going on with all of these chronic issues of health and degenerative disease processes, again, associated with aging.
So you mentioned that fish oil, for example, is good for the brain, and that people should continue to look for supplements to help that sort of thing. I was surprised to hear that the brain is 60% fat.
That's the estimations. And so when we talk about a diet, as I referred to earlier, it is crucial that we maintain a healthy diet for supplying ourselves with these nutrients that not only produce a nice healthy environment in our body to control inflammation and oxidative stress, but nourish our body in very important ways, whether it be energy metabolism or the structural components of our cellular membranes. And one of the things that's been very popular out there to adopt in one's way of thinking about this is to incorporate an anti-inflammatory diet. You may have heard of that, Bonnie.
And I have, but I want to hear some more.
Well, an anti-inflammatory diet, that's a diet that's rich in these foods, the fruits and vegetables, and sometimes it's referred to as a model as the Mediterranean diet. So a diet that's rich in fruits and vegetables and healthy fats, olive oil and fish fat. And of course, you can take these substances in supplementation, and that can be a very, very important part in optimizing your health, particularly when you are really wanting to do that in a more proactive way and are working with somebody that's going to be your guide and helping you to not only look at where you stand with the need for some of these nutrients, but what might be the more appropriate dosing. Now, with that said, if you adopt an anti-inflammatory diet that's rich in these natural anti-inflammatory antioxidant molecules, and you have a nice variety of healthy fats in there, and I'm going to mention again that saturated fat is healthy. It's all about the balance, because there's way too much bad information out there about fats being bad for you, particularly saturated fats.
And I heard recently that people actually want to avoid a low-fat diet, that is actually counterproductive to health.
Yeah, so at one time, you know, that was a bit of a fad. And I'll say that there is a lot of research that links high saturated fat diets to disease processes like diabetes and Alzheimer's disease. So again, it's all about the balance, all right? Saturated fat in excess is bad, but guess what? Excess omega-3s are not so good for you too. As a matter of fact, in the testing that I do and have done, we look at the fatty acid balance in the body and make sure that you're not skewing over towards what's called an omega-3 dominance. So part of the issue with inflammation and how fats play a role in controlling that is a balance between omega-3s and omega-6s. and the standard American diet, which is often referred to as the SAD diet, the acronym for Standard American Diet, and the overconsumption of foods that tend to be pro-inflammatory. And those foods often are very high in omega-6s. And when you have a high ratio of omega-6 to omega-3, that is a pro-inflammatory, okay? Omega-3s need to be balanced, and a healthy ratio is going to be between 4, 3, and 2 to 1 of 6 to 3, omega-6 to omega-3. And as they've looked at these issues of inflammation and dietary patterns in the population, they've seen that that ratio is skewed more to like 20 and 30 to 1 of omega-6 to omega-3.
Wow.
Because of high consumption of omega-6s. So that's why fish oil has gotten very popular. Everybody basically understands that as of now. And there may be a few people that haven't caught on, but it's just because they don't want to. You know, they like their lifestyle and they're going to enjoy it no matter what. But eventually it's going to result in some problems as you age. So if you're invested in aging well, these are very, very important points to make note of. So again, the Mediterranean diet as an example, and there is the paleo diet. And what's probably a little bit more advantageous of the paleo model over the Mediterranean model is that the paleo model tends to indicate that grains may not be such a great part of that Mediterranean diet, and you want to do a lot less of that in what may be referred to as a modified paleo diet. So a pure paleo diet would not have any grains in it. That is considered to be our ancestral diet, or what we as hunters and gatherers became accustomed to, which was actually very, very healthy for us because it naturally had a very good ratio of fats in that diet. And it included in the gathering process berries and fruits that were very important in that balance as well, too. One of the things I love to talk about when I talk about this balance is the Chinese model of yin and yang. And some foods have a very yang nature, and they need to be counterbalanced with more yin foods. And yin foods are vegetables and fruits, and our yang foods are meats. And if you look at a plate, and this is what a lot of practitioners in functional medicine will describe, is you want to have a plate with your protein on it, very limited amount of carbohydrates, and lots of yin foods, lots of fruits and vegetables that are very alkalinizing to the system and help to balance those effects in the body in terms of how those foods affect metabolism and an acid-alkaline balance, and also a balance that is more favorable to controlling inflammation and producing nice effects on the body in terms of the control of some of these metabolic processes associated with oxidative stress.
Excellent. It sounds like we've just come up with another future topic for a future podcast show, which is all about the alkalizing acid balance and how you look at that. I'm interested in that. So we'll talk about that later, Ralph. But for now, for our listeners, thank you very much for listening. That was the third in our three-part series, reviewing the contents of Chapter 1 of Ralph's forthcoming book, The Diabetic Brain. On the next Alzheimer's Solution Show, our show number 4, we are going to focus on genetic markers, and specifically the APOE4 genetic marker and why it is a significant risk factor for Alzheimer's disease. So thanks for listening, and until next time, we'll see you then.
Thanks again, Bonnie. Really appreciate your time.
Thanks, Ralph.
Thanks for listening to the Alzheimer's Solution Show. If you'd like information regarding Ralph Sanchez's consulting services, please go to the contact page of thealzheimersolution.com. Thealzheimersolution.com is your resource for Alzheimer's disease prevention and education information. Please tell others about the Alzheimer's Solution Show, and once again, thanks for listening.